We'll call the meeting to order. I would like to welcome everyone participating in today's meeting or listening online. This meeting is streamlining live on SD.net, a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. The meeting is also being recorded, and the audio will be made available online following the meeting. To find the audio recording online, do a web search for South Dakota Boards and Commissions portal, follow the link, and select the name of the board. For the benefit of our online listeners, I request that all participants, including board members, please identify yourself when speaking. Participants are reminded to keep their microphones or phones muted at all times unless speaking. Okay, Brenda, you want to call the roll?
Yep. England?
Here.
Carpin?
Here.
Morris?
Here.
Greenfield?
Here.
Peterson?
Here.
Sheets? Blumhart?
Here. We have a quorum.
Yep.
Okay. First on the agenda is approval of the minutes from the March 17th meeting, and I think Daryl had a correction he found.
Yeah, it's on the mining issues consent calendar portion of the minutes, which is on the front page near the bottom, not quite at the bottom, but in the second paragraph. It refers to a Don Creech earlier in that sentence, and then later it has Don Dreech, and I believe it's Creech, change the D to a K. And with that, I would approve the minutes. That's corrected.
Second. Second by Greg. Further comments? Hearing none. I suppose we better do it.
We can do a voice.
We can do? Okay. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. All right. Now we get down to the fun stuff, the reason we get to get together. Public hearing to consider the second round review of state implementation plan for the regional haze program. Rick and Anthony, yeah. The floor is yours.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Rick Boddicker with the Air Quality Program. Today, after a few attempts, we are in fact here to discuss South Dakota's second round regional aid state implementation plan. As mentioned, with us is Anthony Lee and Duncan Yakubowski with the Air Program. Anthony completed a majority of the work on this current plan and and will be providing a presentation on the work that we've accomplished and kind of where we're going from here. Following the presentation, Duncan will be providing a summarized version of comments that we received from the federal land managers during their required 60-day federal land management comment period, and also a few comments from the public that we received during the 30-day public comment period. I should mention the 30-day public comment period closed yesterday, and we did receive some last-minute comments from the EPA, the Sierra Club, and one short comment from the National Park Service, which was basically a kind of just a follow-up to their original comments. So we'll probably address those after we go through the presentation of the other comments. I can hand these out through now or else at the time when they're finished up. So. Just to give you a quick recap on the history of our regional haze program, we submitted our original regional haze state implementation plan in 2011. That plan was approved by EPA. The majority of that work included the controls at Big Stone that were required. We followed that up with a five-year progress report in 2016, which kind of showed improvements that were made from those controls and other controls at facilities throughout the region. That five-year progress report was also approved by EPA. And finally, I'd just like to mention we're not proposing any new rules during this round. Following the presentation, I guess we would ask that you approve the SIP as drafted and, in fact, agree that we're making reasonable progress at our Class 1 areas, which we'll discuss more in the presentation from the other. So, and of course, you all know Kyrick, the veteran, so I forgot to introduce him. Sorry about that. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to Anthony. You can start the presentation.
My name is Anthony Lee. Can everyone hear me okay with the microphone?
This is South Dakota's Regional Aid States Implementation Plan. The presentation I'll be presenting is under the same format as the SIP was written, so there are five separate chapters presented on here. Chapter number one is the introduction chapter. Here's just a brief summary of disability impairments and a brief background. Regional AIDS is defined as disability impairments that occurs from multiple sources over a wide geographic area. Both natural and anthropogenic sources of disability impairments can occur and cause problems. Two major disability-impairing substances include nitrates and sulfates. Not only do these pollutants affect many of the aesthetics of a certain series you can see on the right in this picture, also environmental damage and human health problems can occur. Thanks to programs like Regional AIDS Rule, over the past couple of decades, disability has been improved. The brief history of Regional AIDS is that in 1977, the Federal Clean Air Act was amended by adding Section 169A, where Congress declared as a national goal the prevention of the future and remedy of the existing impairments of disability in mandatory classroom federal areas, which inherently results from man-made air pollution. In 1990, the Clean Air Act was amended again with Section 169B. In 1997, the Western Regional Air Partnership, or RAP, was established. In 1999, the final Regional AIDS Rule was adopted and it was revised in 2017. And the ultimate goal of the Regional AIDS Rule is natural disability conditions at all 156 mandatory classroom federal areas by the year 2064. There are 156 classroom areas in the country. South Dakota has two of them, Badlands National Park and Boone Cave National Park. This is Chapter 2, South Dakota's Disability Conditions Regulations. The improved monitors are the make up the backbone of the data that is collected for the subsequent analyses that can be used in part with the Regional AIDS program. These monitors are composed of aerosol and optical samplers. Data from the improved monitors are then turned into or constructed or transitioned into DESC views, which is the main disability metric used in the Regional AIDS Rule. The definition of one DESC view is the minimal humanly perceptible change in disability. And as you can see in the bottom scale here, as DESC views go down, the visual range increases. This is a quick illustration of the differences in the same scenery, but with varying DESC view values. The top left image is the clearest image, the bottom right is the most impaired. And then everyone would agree that the top left image is the one that we all prefer to look at. The requirements of the Regional AIDS Rule is to calculate baseline disability conditions. These were calculated from the years 2000 to 2004 using the 20% most impaired days. And the average of those 20% most impaired days for each year was then taken. Each of the 5 years were then also averaged as the 5-year average. Natural disability conditions were also calculated. These were a little bit more complicated because it's only a best estimate. No one was around before humans existed to be able to take these measurements. Here are two equations that show what, in part, what was used to calculate natural disability conditions. Current disability conditions were also required to be calculated. They are simply calculated using the same strategy as the baseline disability conditions, except the years used for 2014 to 2018 instead of 2000 to 2004. Progress to date is also a requirement to be calculated. It's simply the difference between the baseline period 5-year average and the current disability 5-year average. As you can see from the chart here, for the Badlands National Park, for the average of the most impaired days, progress to date is 2.7 decibels. For Boone Cave National Park, there's a similar story, the progress to date is 2.6 decibels. These charts show the same information as the previous charts, except one additional two additional pieces of information. One is it breaks down the disability impairments by the pollutants sources, including sources, and it also includes the 2064 end goal disability goal and aerosol light extinction. As you can see, the 2000 to 2004 baseline period compared to the current conditions, there has been improvement, but there's still some improvement which needs to be done. A similar story can be seen for McKay National Park, where there has been some progress made, but there's still some progress to be made before the end goal is reached. The difference between impairments and natural disability conditions also needs to be calculated. That is simply taking current conditions minus the natural disability conditions. And finally, the uniform rate of progress was the requirements to be calculated, and it is simply taking it's drawing a straight line from the baseline period of disability conditions to the 2064 end goal disability conditions. This chart shows the European life slope superimposed over the improved data from 2000 to 2018. As you can see, for Badlands National Park, we are on track to meet our 2064 end goal. The same can be said for Wind Cave National Park. Regional aid rule also allows for an adjustment to the uniform rate of progress, and South Dakota decided to take advantage of this adjustment. The adjustments can be made for international anthropogenic emissions and for prescribed fire emissions. South Dakota chose to eliminate these emissions because they cannot control international anthropogenic emissions and prescribed fire emissions to emulate natural emissions. The dotted green line is the adjusted glide slope. Also included is a horizontal black line, which shows if current visibility conditions, as indicated by the 5-year average from 2014 to 2018, doesn't change until the year 2035, we would still jump to the region of 2064 and more. According to the adjusted glide slope for Badlands National Park, for Wind Cave National Park, you can see we're a little bit further ahead of schedule than at Badlands National Park. The current facility conditions do not change whatsoever until the year 2050. We would still be on track to reaching our 2064 end goal. Chapter 3 is the long-term strategy for regional haze. The long-term strategy is defined as the analyses that are required to make reasonable progress goal visibility projections. This includes the source selection step, source control measure characterization step, and also a few other additional items to be considered. So step one is determining which facilities to screen in for a subsequent control measure analysis. This analysis is called the emissions over distance, or Q over D analysis. Q simply stands for emissions, D stands for distance. And the emissions are from any given point source or facility, and the distance is to any given class one area. The threshold used by most draft states for this analysis is the value of 10. However, when self-declared in the analysis ourselves, we found that only one source was screened in. Therefore, we used the more stringent threshold of 2, so that we were able to screen in 2 sources. The data was from the 2014 NEI V2, and these charts show for Badlands and Wind Cave National Parks for total Q over D that GCC Dakota is the only facility that had a Q over D of over 10. It's ranked number 13 in terms of impacts for Badlands and number 7 for Wind Cave. These charts simply break down the total Q over D into NOx and SO2. Similar story, GCC Dakota is the only facility and it's ranked fairly far down the list in each table. These are Q over D values at out-of-state class 1 areas, and it's pretty evident that none of our in-state facilities significantly impact visibility at any outside of the state class 1 areas. The largest QRD value for PMR facilities is 3.75, which is well below the 10 threshold. Randall was contracted by RAD to use the model, and they also did a 2028 projected emissions QRD analysis. It's interesting to note that according to their analysis, it seems as if in-state facilities are not going to be impacting classroom areas as much as they were in 2014. You can see there are no in-state facilities that are shown to impact Badlands or Badlands for NYX or SO2. Another quick thing I wanted to mention with these tables was the fact that Charles Gentleman Station in Nebraska is consistently shown to impact our classroom areas the most out of any facility in any state. This is for Wind Cave National Park. GCC Dakota is shown to impact Wind Cave or NOx, ranks number 9. Second of two analyses used to screen in sources was the weighted emissions potential or an area of influence or WEF AOI analysis. This was again provided by contractor Ramble. There were four products produced. The first three built on each other, and the third one showed the same information for the therefore we focus on the fourth product in the presentation. It's important to note that these numbers, they're relative numbers, and they're unitless, they're not probabilities, so there's no defined threshold that can be used to compare between classroom areas. But the numbers can still give an indication of what could be just a facility which impacts visibility negatively. So for 2028 at Badlands for NO3, the WebAOI analysis shows that GCC Dakota is the fourth ranked facility that impacts visibility or is projected to impact visibility. For SO4, it's ranked number 10. For Wind Cave National Park, for NO3, GCC Dakota is ranked number 1. Kindred and Sons shows up and it's ranked number 7. For SO4 at Wind Cave, GCC Dakota is ranked number 6. And this just shows that out of all of the out-of-state classroom areas, the only facility within our state that shows up in this analysis is Otter Tail Power Company, which is ranked fairly low on each table for NO3 and SO4. It affects Poitras classroom area in Minnesota. The conclusion was that, according to now that the facilities have been identified, the next step was to select and characterize emission control measures for physical exposures. A set of all potentially applicable control measure options must first be identified. Those control measure possibilities were identified for line kilns and dry cement kilns, as these are the devices at Pete and Sons and GCC Dakota, which were the emissions producing devices. So looking at technically feasible self-driving backside control technologies, GCC Dakota identified the following possible control options for sulfur dioxide. The two which were determined as technically feasible were wet scrubbing and semi-wet / dry scrubbing. For nitrogen oxide control technologies, both GCC Dakota and Pete & Sons identified that selective non-catalytic reduction, or SNCR, was considered potentially technically feasible. Now that the set of potentially technically feasible control measures have been identified, the characterization of those control measures is necessary. This was done through a four-factor analysis. The four factors in the four-factor analysis are the cost of compliance factor, the time necessary for compliance factor, the energy and non-air quality environmental impacts of compliance factor, and the remaining useful life factor. This table emphasizes the cost of compliance factor. As you can see, the cost per ton, which is the metric we used to help determine cost of compliance for SNCR, was $2,094 per ton. This number became outdated after the COVID situation occurred, and a few months ago, GCC Dakota submitted outdated numbers getting more accurate how the situation has become more, it's become more accurate since COVID. The numbers have gone up, and it is now closer to $5,000 per ton to implement this control option. For PD and Sons, we're also emphasizing cost compliance factor and stable. For SNCR, at both mills, the cost per ton is $34,000 and $58,000, respectively. South Dakota's determined that either of these control options were cost-effective. Chapter 4 is the reasonable progress goal chapter. Reasonable progress goals, again, are defined as the 2028 projections of facility due to the determination of the long-term strategy. So whatever emissions changes were going to occur because of the long-term strategy. There are many steps to determine the reasonable progress goals, but we've done all of them so far with the exception of modeling the end of the implementation plan period feasibility. This chart shows superimposed over the URP glide slopes and the improved data, the 2028 facility projections for Badlands National Park. It follows the initial glide slope pretty similarly to the improved data as we run at running track according to that metric. And we are again ahead of schedule according to the adjusted glide slope. This chart is important to remember and to note because it shows out of all of the visibility impairing sources, whether they be anthropogenic or natural, whether they come from outside this country or from within this country, which sources impact visibility the greatest. And of these colors, they're ranked from most to least significant. And it's a little bit hard to see, but there's a section at the way top of this graph which is composed of a dozen different colors. And within that are all six of South Dakota sources combined. That's significant because all of them combined produce less than a fraction of SWU in the change to visibility if all of them were eliminated. And it's less than 1% of all visibility impairing sources when you connect the big picture. So even if all of South Dakota sources of pollution were eliminated, there would be a very negligible change in visibility impairments at that national park. It's also important to note that there's this black horizontal line indicating that if visibility projections for 2028 end up occurring and the models are correct, then from that point, if visibility doesn't change until the year 2047, roughly, we would still be on track to reaching our 2064 end goal. Chart which shows somewhat of the information that specifies U.S. anthropogenic sources for ammonium nitrate at Badlands National Park. But it paints a good picture indicating how South Dakota it produces a small amount of visibility impairment compared to other states, including non-RAF states. The largest part of South Dakota's emissions, visibility impairing emissions, come from mobile sources, which is the red color. And those sources are not controllable by the states. They're federally controllable. For ammonium sulfates, you can also see that South Dakota produces a very small amount of visibility impairments compared to other states. This is the same analysis for Wind Cave National Park as before. What's most significant about this chart and the situation is that if you look at the horizontal black line, the visibility conditions occur as modeled by 2028. If visibility does not change from that point on, we will have reached our 2064 end goal over 30 years ahead of schedule. The bar chart situation is the same as Badlands National Park, where less than 1% of visibility impairments overall occurs from South Dakota sources, and they result in a fraction of the 1% of visibility impairments in total. Again, just emphasizing how small South Dakota sources compared to other U.S. anthropogenic sources impact visibility negatively at Wind Cave National Park. Again, the biggest contributor from sources within the state is from mobile sources. For ammonium sulfates, the same situation occurred the overall picture is just a snapshot of one classroom area outside of our state, but it's very representative of all the classroom areas outside of our state, where South Dakota does not produce much visibility impairments, and the state that the classroom area that is located in typically produces among the most visibility impairments. This is Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and as you can see, North Dakota produces the majority of visibility impairments for both ammonium nitrate and ammonium sulfate. Finally, South Dakota's determination is no additional control measures are necessary during the second implementation plan period. A couple of the points we want to emphasize, because as justification for our determination is that there is no cutoff metric or threshold defined in the regional AIDS rule for any of the four factors. This gives states flexibility and it allows the states to interpret the rule to come up with its own thresholds in order to make its own determinations. The cost of compliance factor was the factor which used the most additional information to help determine what threshold to use. One of the requirements of the regional AIDS rule is found at 40 CFR section 51.308 at 3IBE, which indicates that visibility is a necessary component to consider in determining the long-term strategy. DNR also reviewed its state statutes and Supreme Court rulings to help make this decision. It also referenced two other sections of the regional AIDS rule, one of which states that there could be considered, this is up for interpretation, but it could be considered a safe harbor, which is less stringent than the RP light smoke, which we'll get into a little bit more with the following comments. But this part of the regional AIDS rule states that the long-term strategy and reasonable progress goals must provide for an improvement in disability for the most severe days through today's time period and ensure no degradation to disability for the clearest days since the baseline period. This is something that South Dakota has met this requirement and therefore believes to be making reasonable progress. The time necessary for compliance factor and for remaining useful life factor were not main considerations in South Dakota's determination, but they were still considered. And energy and non-air quality environmental impacts of compliance factor, the main factor considered within this was our national air and air quality standards concerns, mainly within the Rapid City area for the criteria of PM10. The phenomenon of ammonia slip was of concern to South Dakota because it is a phenomenon that is known to increase PM10 concentrations, and Rapid City has had a history of getting close to being in non-attainment in years past, and therefore any additional PM10 concentrations added to that already precarious situation, we don't think is a wise decision. Two other final points: the states have until 2064 to meet this goal. We believe that reaching the goal 30 years ahead of schedule is plenty of time, and we have much more time after the 2028 30 implementation time period SIP to make adjustments if necessary if we are not indeed going to reach the goal or if the model in this round is not quite accurate. And it's also finally important to note that in our decision, we looked at what other states in the West had determined regarding their control measures, and there are only a handful of states in the West which have determined that control measures are necessary during the same implementation time period. So we are among the majority of states determining no additional controls are necessary. That wraps up the presentation. I would like to ask if you have any questions at this point, or if you would prefer to have Duncan and I read our comments and summaries and responses to the FLM comments.
I think first we'll go, any board members have any questions before we go into the comment section? Bob?
Mr. Chair, we got a lot of information, hard copy, and just now. so kind of bear with me a little bit. So we have an implementation plan that was established in 2011, approved by the EPA.
Correct.
And then what y'all are doing here now is, my interpretation is that you are assessing whether your existing implementation plan needs to be tweaked at all.
That's probably a fair assessment. The regional haze program requires us to, every 10 years, redo the implementation plan. So we have to go through this whole analysis again,
okay,
and determine if we have to put a additional controls on it. The idea is we project, if we're kind of the planner, we're going to put controls on what happens in 10 years. Do we need to go farther additionally? So each year we have to do that.
Sure.
In 2011, of course, we had the controls for Big Stone, which is kind of big.
Right.
Hard sourcing, that was the big here and there, so everything else kind of runs, you know. So now, once those are done, now they look at other sources, you know.
Yeah,
and controls on these, they look at other sources in 10 years.
No. Right, and my interpretation of this is that there were two sources, Peak Lean and the cement plant. There was an evaluation of that, the cost, the haze, all that stuff. And ultimately, at the end of the day, is what you're saying is that my understanding is we don't need to do anything through this analysis to change our existing implementation plan because we're essentially on track. Is that right?
Well, that's essentially our belief.
Okay.
So there's no, as I think Anthony mentioned, there's no, on the cost analysis, there's no fine number. Colorado's opinion could be 10,000 a ton is worth it, and somebody else's could be 2,000 or whatever.
Sure.
So our belief is, yes, that, at this time, it doesn't make sense to put expensive control on these two facilities because we don't believe we're going to see enough improvements. Now, when they talk through the comments, you see that they, of course, disagree, which isn't a surprise. They believe that they are cost-effective and that we should put controls on them. So
okay. Not,
that answers your question.
That gives me a better understanding.
Yeah.
Because when I was reading all this scientific stuff...
And I think one thing to note is, as he's mentioned, it's a goal, first of all.
Sure.
It's 2064. And it's never been really discussed what happens when you actually, if you are below that 2064 goal. EPA doesn't know that. We don't know. So they're going to make us continue to do this. But, our opinion is right now it doesn't make sense to put any controls on these things because, Anthony and I had a phone call with the Forest Service just last winter where they essentially, he mentioned the adjustments to the IPAP to take out international and prescribed fire emissions. So that line went up. The gist of the call from the Forest Service was to say, hey, by the way, we're going to increase prescribed burning 2 to 3-fold over the next 10 years. We think you should push EPA to adjust that even higher, because they're going to increase burning. They don't want, of course, to be responsible for
sure.
Those problems. So, in our opinion, why would we put controls on these facilities now? We know that they're going to increase burning, which is going to be the true visibility impairer at our class 1 areas.
And I think part of our jurisdiction is we addressed air quality permitting process. Is when we do that, and the people who or the industry that seeks air quality permitting is the haze parameters. Part of that permitting process where the contributor has to understand what we have as goals, and then you all work with them to address their permitting maximums?
Yeah, I believe visibility is part of the process. I'll let Carrick discuss that.
The help on the permitting side, like Big Stone, we went through it and we identified they need to put controls on. That was part of that implementation plan, says we had to develop rules that basically applied to Big Stone, and these are the limits they had to apply. Once we went to the rulemaking process, which was part of the implementation plan, then we go back to the permit and implement those limits into the permit. So it's kind of we have to have an underlying reason why we put those permits or limits into the permit. this is that first step where we have to identify, do we need additional controls in front of what we're asking? Do you agree? We're saying no, or you disagree. Is that if we need to put limits in or put additional controls on, then we have to go through a rulemaking process to establish those limits. Once those limits are established in rule, then we move into the permanent.
Okay. Out western South Dakota, there'll be air quality alert days and stuff like that. And when that happens, you definitely see that there's, you know, visibility is impaired. How does the industry out there, the permittees, how do they respond if there's a problem? Do they work with you all? Do you work with them? Does everybody have sort of a common goal in terms of the industry and the department?
We have a common goal, but when we're talking about the Rapid City dust portion, I'm going to now go to another outside of regional haze. I'm going to talk about a different metric. That is our national ambient air quality standards. What we have identified is because of the quarries, when the wind comes up, the natural portion, it re-trains all the dust, and it causes issues with those national ambient air quality standards, national standard. We have worked with the industry out there to develop what we call a natural events action plan. So if the winds are supposed to come up and we have that moisture, the National Weather Service identifies that this is a potential issue. The industry has basically agreed, and we put in permits to do additional controls. They'll do, like, water the roads more. Maybe not, let's say, blast during that time period. So we minimize that so we don't impact the national ambient quality standard. So that is part of the permits for the Rapid City area.
Okay. So, but at the end of the day, at least at this point, based upon the analysis of the presentation, there is no recommendation that the original implementation plan be modified in any way.
I have to be careful when I say that is, we'll have to submit this implementation plan to EPA for approval because we have to prove that we went through all these steps.
Sure.
Our recommendation is through that review that we do not need to establish rules or regulation for additional limits or controls to put on to our industry. That's the overall end recommendation.
So what you're seeking from this board is a motion to approve that recommendation, and then that allows you to submit it to the EPA.
Correct. We'll submit that whole package that we're not putting controls on during this period.
Okay.
That's because we believe we are making reasonable progress towards the natural conditions goal.
Any other?
Rick? So, for lack of better words, was this all part of the, what I want to call acid rain? When this was adopted in response to acid rain years ago, if I remember right.
Not exactly.
But that's one of the...
It's considering the same similar pollutants as acid rain.
Right, sulfate.
Sulfates, correct.
Right.
It does, but it's looking at a different metric.
Okay.
The acid rain program was developed for the National Ambient Quality Standards, which are health-based standards. This had more to do with, they call it the Grand Canyon Commission. You can go back farther in history. And you couldn't see the Grand Canyon during the early hazy days, and they identified these are the pollutants that are issued. So they developed another metric to determine if you want additional controls.
Right. It just so happens that they wound up being a lot of the same things to measure that they measured for the acid rain. So I wanted to make sure I heard this right, that all of South Dakota's sources are less than 1% of the total sources. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct. And that analysis was originally conducted by our state. It was conducted by North Dakota. And they shared their procedure of how to determine it's that a normalization is the process. And we followed their step-by-step procedure and came up with those numbers. And I think it's a similar story in their state. Not quite as dramatic as ours, but it paints a very good big picture view.
Yeah, so we're looking at two sites out of all the sites in South Dakota, and out of all of our sources, they contribute to less than 1%.
They're getting even smaller than that because I think that analysis at less than 1% included all of South Dakota's emissions, not just peat leans and GCs.
Okay.
So that would be even smaller percentage.
Right. Okay.
So what kind of stack testing do they have on, like, say, these specific facilities' requirements? Are they the 3 to 5 years for their permit? Or, do they have kind of SEMS or a PEMS unit attached? How often are they verifying that these numbers are accurate?
Again, we're talking now compliance with the permit. We're going away from visibility. So we're talking, like, GCC Dakota has a continuous emission monitoring system for nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, and some other pollutants. Now I'm trying to remember peat leans, I believe. Peat leans, I also believe, might have a CM system. I don't recall off the top of my head. But they have other standards that they're required to do annual testing or once every 5 years.
Okay.
And that either might be because they don't have a CM system or because they have to audit the continuous emission monitoring system. They have to do that at least once a year.
Sure. Okay, and then one other question I had. So for the sites that, or the states that did determine that they needed additional control devices, was, say, Nebraska one of those, since they're such a huge contributor to our emissions? Or how, what kind of pull does each state have for that? Say, you're contributing to our emissions, what are you going to do about it, or is there any?
We had consultation with the state of Nebraska over the Gerald Gentleman facility, because that is obviously the biggest contributor to us. And I guess our as a department, our philosophy is that, and this is kind of the tough part, is, you know, EPA wants us, the state of South Dakota, to tell Nebraska to put controls on. They don't want to do it, so our philosophy, I guess, is as long as we're under the glide path and we're still making progress, we're not going to go after these other states to say, hey, you need to put controls on here. And we have calls with them, and they have no intentions, I don't believe, this round, putting any controls on them.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from board members? I will say I can remember this in 2011. We had that meeting. It was out in Custer. And that's the point where I asked the question, simple logic of us simple people, is how does Big Stone affect Wind Cave? How does the pollution at Big Stone, I said, I can understand, it goes all the way around the world and comes back. But I was informed that this is how things are, so.
I think you were the chairman today when we were talking about this.
All right, so you said we have some comments, so I suppose we should listen to those.
There's going to be two sets of comments, so I'm going to do it. We received the comments the first time we tried to do this because the federal land managers get a 60-day, they get their own 60-day comment period. When we open that up, they go through those, and then we'll have a second one. During this last 30 days, we'll receive additional comments at the last minute that EPA submitted 4:30 yesterday afternoon, so we'll go through those too.
Okay, and just to let any board members that have any questions of the comments as they come, we'll stop the comment at that time and handle that comment one at a time. But if we don't have any, just keep running them by us.
Can everyone hear me okay? So my name is Dr. Dan Grossi. I'm going to be providing a summary of the comments from the public and that balance that we received, and then Anthony will be providing subsequent response to those comments.
Okay.
So the following comment is from Ottertail. They're saying, Big Stone plant completed a $365 million air quality control system in late 2015 that has reduced emissions of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides by more than 90%. Big Stone plant's distance from Class 1 areas in South Dakota paired with a 90%+ reductions in SO2 and NOx emissions from their installation of BART in Round 1 makes them an insignificant contributor to visibility impairment in Class 1 areas.
DANR's response is that DANR agrees with Ottertail Power Company's statements and thanks Ottertail Power Company for commenting.
The next comment is from GCC Dakota. The first four-factor analysis conducted by GCC Dakota found that SNCR was a technically feasible control technology for the GCC Dakota kiln. However, the cost was underestimated using EPA's Air Pollution Control Cost Manual, or CCM. Costs were adjusted to reflect more accurately what it would cost GCC Dakota to implement a SNCR system, resulting in an annual cost increase of over $900,000, doubling the previous calculations. This supports the conclusion that SNCR is not an appropriate emission reduction measure. GCC Dakota wants to emphasize that the installation of SNCR could result in an ammonia slip that could negatively impact the PM air concentrations in the Rapid City area.
DNR's response is DNR thanks GCC Dakota for providing updated cost estimates in these tumultuous times. DNR has taken the updated cost estimates into account and has determined they will not change DNR's initial determination, but instead bolster its decision. DNR also agrees with the GCC Dakota about the ammonia slip concept.
The following comments are a combination from the National Park Service and the United States Forest Service, just because they have a lot of overlapping ideologies. So comment number one, both National Park Service, or NPS, and the United States Forest Service, USFS, believe that the South Dakota Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources, DANR, did not fully complete the four-factor analysis used to determine if control measures should be implemented, as well as the analysis does not meet the requirements of the regional haze rule. NPS and USFS believe that being under the glide slope does not allow the state to dismiss the implementation of otherwise technically feasible and cost-effective controls. All factors must be equally considered when concluding the analysis.
DANR's response is that DANR did conduct a complete four-factor analysis, which does meet all requirements as stated in the regional haze rule. DNR did not dismiss the implementation of otherwise technically feasible and cost-effective controls because of its Class 1 area's position to the URP glide slope. DNR used its Class 1 area's positioning relative to the URP glide slope as one means by which to help analyze the cost of compliance factor to help determine which control measures should be considered cost-effective.
So then, if I'm understanding what you just said, is that they feel that we should implement these additional controls to GCC?
I think the easiest answer, yes. They believe that they're cost effective at that $2,000 per ton or $5,000 per ton, and we disagree. It gets back to, how do you define what's cost effective? It's not defined in rule. It just says we have to consider it. There's not a number. What do you take into account? Unfortunately, you're going to hear a similar concept through most of these comments. How do you do that? As we kind of answered, it's showing where we're currently at as far as that glide slope, where we're currently going to meet in 2064, like in Wind Cave, we're already projected to meet it. What's considered cost effective? What number should we use? Our, if it is $2,000 per ton when we're already meeting it, is not cost effective. They're going to argue that it is cost effective.
So basically, they're saying that the product that GCC would turn out would be cost effective. I mean, because it's going to raise their cost to a point where that product is going to be extremely expensive.
When we do the analysis, we don't take into account what it increased the cost of the product. We only take into account what it would cost to reduce the emissions. So it's going to cost them $2,000 for every ton that they reduce.
And I understand that, but I'm saying those of us who are you're talking to who live in the real world have to understand that decisions we make here affect the people of South Dakota and other states, because GCC does a lot of business around here.
And they're going to raise their cost to cover the cost.
Yeah, and I guess that's something that we as a board need to consider. But,
and that's from an agency whose wildfires contribute to haze much more than any of the other sources.
That is correct.
But, Mr. Chair, but as I understand it, the rules allow you to go through the four-factor analysis, and you perform that, and that you use that to assist you in making the no recommendation determination.
That is also correct.
From a standpoint, you know, we're looking out at 2064, so we're, what, 42 years away. I have to imagine Pete Lean and Sons, the cement plant, will be doing capital improvements, changes, and all that. Historically, do they consider, or do you know if they've considered this analysis, the Hayes implementation plan and stuff, in terms of any capital or infrastructure changes that they do?
That gets into the permitting side. I apologize because I don't get to work on the permitting side. Is depending if they trigger what we call a PSD permit or prevention of significant deterioration, one of the categories they have to look at is visibility of class one areas. Generally, what that occurs is if they're increasing emissions. Most projects moving forward more than likely are decreasing because technology has improved. Or the other reason is they don't want to trigger PSD and have to go through that process. This is basically underneath the regional Hayes, looks at more of what's existing and should you go from what's existing and already make them improve it outside of those normal everyday capital processes and programs.
Okay, so what the commenters wanted you to do is require, or by rule, make it so that these two sources make a capital investment to reduce the issues that have been identified.
Correct. They want us to require those controls, not allow them to be, we're not talking about capital as far as improving their product or increasing effect, just putting controls on to reduce emissions, which reduces visibility effects.
But Pete Lean and Dakota Cement are aware of these recommendations, and our hope would be as they move on in the future that they would take into consideration, in any changes in their operations, they would take into consideration these issues.
I would assume they would be aware of those portions, and we've talked to both of those companies. We also talked about we received comments and they may be online listening for this discussion. So sure. I'm going to say they should be aware of it. We've had discussions with it, and they may be also online listening to this conversation.
Okay.
So you have to do the four-factor analysis, but there's no best available technology requirement under this program.
There's not a specified one. It just talks about we have to take these factors into account and identify if we want to do those controls based on those four factors. And that's a decision, and as Anthony's mentioned, it's not defined. It says consider control, consider cost. What cost do you?
Right, but there's no best available technology requirement.
Like in 2011, you had the BART, which was a required, you know, EGU was over a certain age and a certain tonnage were automatically screened in. So that kind of goes back, you know, Bigstone at that time kind of agreed to put on the controls because they knew, you know, they were aging and they needed to eventually do it. So they went ahead and put the controls on, you know, 2015.
Well, you might as well give us some more comments.
The second comment, both NPS and USFS believe that GCC Dakota should add cost-effective control technology to control the amount of NOx and SO2 emissions released yearly. NPS believes GCC Dakota overestimated costs for controls and believes that even with the overestimation, estimates are within the range of the cost-effectiveness threshold. The state is concerned that requiring SNCR will result in ammonia slip. However, NPS is aware of other plants operating SNCR without this issue.
DNR's response is that DNR does not believe the costs for controls at GCC Dakota were originally overestimated. Regardless, the original numbers are now outdated as GCC Dakota provided updated cost estimates due to changes in materials and supply chain issues since the original four-factor analysis had been completed. DNR acknowledges the selective non-catalytic reduction system may be able to be adjusted to maximize NOx reduction while minimizing ammonia slip. However, DNR is prioritizing maintaining and meeting the national ambient air quality standard over visibility goal of natural background by 2064 that South Dakota is projected to already meet by 2028.
Anyone have any questions on that? All right, we might as well keep going.
The following comments are specific to the National Park Service. Comment number one, NPS disagrees with DANR's belief that the uniform rate of progress constitutes a limit on the amount of visibility progress that can be made during a planning period, as well as the belief that the state is legally prohibited from acquiring additional controls when a Class 1 area is below the uniform rate of progress.
DANR's response is that DANR doesn't believe the uniform rate of progress constitutes a limit on the amount of visibility progress that can be made during the planning period. DANR only used the positioning of its Class 1 areas relative to the glide slope as part of its required cost effectiveness determination.
All right.
Second comment. NPS believes that although South Dakota emissions do not significantly impact visibility in Badlands National Park and Wind Cave National Park, based on statements by the EPA, it is not appropriate to reject cost-effective control measures even though the impact on visibility is insignificant. NPS encourages South Dakota to discuss out-of-state emission impacts during state-to-state consultations.
South Dakota did not automatically reject the control measures because of South Dakota's small contribution to visibility impairments. It was instead used as a factor among several other factors to determine what threshold should be considered cost-effective. South Dakota has discussed out-of-state emission impacts throughout the SIF development process through its continuous involvement with the RAP.
The third comment. NPS wants to highlight that although the visibility of the most impaired days at Badlands National Park and Wind Cave National Park have trended down since the year 2000, since 2015 and 2016 respectively, haze has been increasing yearly on the most impaired days. This information highlights the need for continued reductions in emissions.
South Dakota acknowledges this observation. However, due to several different variables, such as weather patterns, climate, and others, DANR expects the visibility will vary each year. However, looking at the full data set, the visibility overall has continued to decrease from calendar year 2000, which is the baseline year for the regional base program.
The fourth comment. Regarding Peatling and Sons, NPS is aware of four lime facilities that are using SNCR indicating that it is a feasible option to reduce NOx emissions. The cost estimates are overestimated based on the use of a high interest rate as well as the cost for a urea agent being substantially more than the default urea cost. The cost analysis also includes a loss of $1.2 to $1.5 million per year due to the loss of kiln dust sales. NPS would like the reasoning for these cost estimates to be fully explained and justified.
In the four-factor analysis, Peatling submitted to DANR. Peatling provided a cost analysis for an SNCR system on its own kiln. DANR did not reject the SNCR system due to technical feasibility. DANR rejected the control due to the cost of the system. For discussion purposes, DANR re-ran Peatling's cost analysis using the National Park Service's preferred interest rate, urea creation cost, and no money lost due to the loss of kiln dust sales. The dollar per ton cost would decrease from approximately $34,000 per ton to approximately $11,400 for kiln number one, and from $58,800 to $17,400 for kiln number two. Even with these revisions, DANR would still consider the SNCR not cost-effective, but not require Peatling and Sons to install the control system at this time.
Well, all I've got to say about that is when you did your, they did their analysis, you did your analysis, if you did it today, with the cost of things today, both your numbers would be so low it'd be unbelievable. But, well, we're just just going to leave it at that.
The final comment from the NPS in this section. NPS believes that the public comment period began before the conclusion of the FLM consultation, which provided no opportunity for DAR to consider this input in the public review version. The schedule did not allow for the for recommendations of FLMs to meaningfully inform the decision of the state.
South Dakota agreed with the National Park Service and as a result provided the public with another 30-day comments period, which included access to these federal land manager comments and responses. South Dakota thanks the National Park Service for making this recommendation.
So that's the first go round of comments?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay. All right. Board members got any questions?
There's more?
Yeah. The late arrivals.
Yeah. Stay awake. All right. So you might as well start the second go around.
Okay. These comments are from the second round. So there's one comment summarized from the NPS. NPS wants to thank the DNR for the opportunity to provide comments on the regional PACE plan for the second implementation period. We would like to emphasize the request for South Dakota to strengthen the SIP and require cost-effective controls to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions from the GCC Dakota facility.
South Dakota thanks the National Park Service for providing additional comments during the public comment period. DANR has decided to stand by its original decision of no additional control measures during the second implementation period.
Okay.
The following comments are from Sierra Club. Comment number one, Sierra Club urges South Dakota to not lean properly on the uniform rate of progress and believes it is inappropriate to use visibility conditions and status of the glide slope to justify not needing additional control measures for GCC Dakota and Pete and Sons.
DNR did not lean improperly on uniform rate of progress, but used it as one of the factors in its cost-effectiveness determination. South Dakota is required to consider the anticipated net effect on visibility due to projected changes in point, area, and mobile source emissions over the period addressed by the long-term strategy, as stated in 40 CFR section 51.308F3IVE.
Comment number two, Sierra Club wants to point out that the data shows distinct upticks in hazy conditions in recent years in Badlands National Park and Whitcave National Park. This demonstrates a need for the state to require emission reductions to avoid the continuation of this trend in the future.
South Dakota acknowledges this observation. However, due to several different variables such as weather patterns, DNR expects the visibility to vary each year. However, looking at the full data set, the visibility overall has continued to increase from calendar year 2000, which again is the baseline period for the regional PACE program.
So the question I have is the other question, how much do they take into account all the fires with all the smoke? Because I still say that's one of our biggest haze problems, especially out in the hills where, you know, I'm out there a lot in the summertime and I still, the fires or the smoke still is the biggest issue that I see.
I guess the easiest one, if you want, if you'll pull up the graph, let's say at Wind Cave, that last little bit, that's where we're adjusting that glide path to take into account those prescribed fires, like that little orangish or yellowish. Yeah, yellowish line I'm looking from here is that's adjusting to account for those prescribed fires.
Yeah.
All those fires. So you can see that's where the big issue is.
Okay.
And
yeah.
The projected, that's the 9.7. We're projecting 2028 with the current rules, most like federal rules on mobile sources that are coming in. We should be around 9.7 and the adjusted is 10.1. We're showing at Wing Cave projected we're already meeting the goal 40 years ahead of schedule.
Okay.
Because of the fires, because that's our biggest issue.
Right. I was going to say, because that's still our big, to my estimation, that's still our biggest issue for visibility.
Yes.
Go on.
Sierra Club supports the NPS comment that states South Dakota is wrong in their interpretation that South Dakota is unable to add additional measures due to them being unwarranted and run contrary to state rule. Sierra Club believes the regional haze rule and the transfer rule are not analogous, and believes that South Dakota is improperly compared to the rules.
South Dakota agrees the transfer rule does not involve disability or the regional haze program. However, the court decision may be used as a guideline on how to interpret similar concepts. The National Park Service is misapplying South Dakota's discussion on its state statutes and the court's decision involving transport approval. South Dakota is referring to the requirements of regional progress, reasonable progress, and the natural background disability threshold, and not the uniform rate of progress. DNR is required by 40 CFR section 51.38 F2IBE when developing its long-term strategy to consider visibility in its decision-making. After analyzing the 2020 projections, DNR found that visibility impairments at one of its class 1 areas will have surpassed the 2064 natural background visibility goal. If the class 1 areas are meeting or projected to meet the natural background visibility goal, South Dakota does not have the authority to require controls that go beyond reasonable progress and or exceed the natural background visibility goal based upon both the state statutes and its review of the concepts behind the court decision on the transport rule.
Sierra Club believes that the state has overestimated the interest rates throughout the proposed SIP. Using the current 3.25% bank prime rate, many control options for both facilities would be even more cost-effective.
DNR considered multiple interest rates and its cost of compliance support factor analysis, including 3.25%, and no interest rates produced with model cost values that were deemed cost-effective.
We won't even touch that right now, what interest rates are going to do, but go ahead.
The remaining comments are from EPA. Comment number one. EPA thanks South Dakota for their effort and work on the draft set and looks forward to continuing to work with the state.
DNR thanks EPA for providing additional comments and also looks forward to continuing to work together.
EPA believes South Dakota should not use visibility to dismiss cost-effective potential controls. EPA would like the state to reconsider its four-factor analysis accordingly to help reach the national goal of preventing and remedying anthropogenic impairment of visibility in Class 1 areas.
As part of the long-term strategy required by the Regional Haze Rule, South Dakota is required to consider the anticipated net effect on visibility due to projected changes in points, area, and mobile source emissions over the period addressed by the long-term strategy, as stated in 40 CFR, section 51.308, F3IVE. South Dakota used this information to help inform its four-factor cost-effectiveness decision.
EPA wants to emphasize that glide path is not a safe harbor, and Class 1 areas below the glide path cannot be used to justify the decision to implement controls. A glide path should be used to gauge the progress that has been made and how much progress is left to make.
South Dakota did not use the glide path as a safe harbor, but did use it to gauge the progress that has been made and how much progress is left to make. This observation was used to help DNR determine which control measures were considered cost-effective. South Dakota also emphasizes the existence of 40 CFR section 51.308F3I, which can be interpreted as a less stringent safe harbor, which states, in part, the long-term strategy and the reasonable progress goals must provide for an improvement in visibility for the most impaired days since the baseline period, and ensure no degradation in visibility for the clearest days since the baseline period. Again, South Dakota has met its requirements and therefore believes to be making reasonable progress.
EPA believes that the state quotes the good neighbor provision out of context. EPA also believes that the state is obligated to reduce causes of regional haze and their claim that, in quotes, DNR may not require emission controls that go above and beyond the regional progress to natural conditions has no legal relevance in this issue.
The and ARC is not pleased to have quoted good neighbor provision out of context and understands that the regional ACE rule and the good neighbor provisions are different, but the concept is still similar.
EPA believes that South Dakota is basing decisions off of the NAAQS and does not believe that it is relevant to the regional ACE rule. EPA believes that South Dakota should determine cost effectiveness for its four-factor analysis strictly based off of information on the guidance and based off information and the guidance found in the regional ACE rule.
South Dakota does think the max is relevant as part of the consideration for control measure inclusion is the environmental impacts factor, and also because it is important to consider human health in decision making.
EPA wants to emphasize that South Dakota cannot use the glide path as a safe harbor when determining justification for a particular set of controls. The glide path is not based on the four statutory factors and cannot be used to determine whether the amount of progress in implementation period is reasonable.
Once again, DANR did not use the glide path as a safe harbor. Although the glide path is not based on the four statutory factors, it was used to help inform South Dakota's cost of compliance factor decision and can be used for that purpose according to the regional ACE rule.
EPA wants to commend the state for considering a more stringent threshold over Q over D screening.
South Dakota thanks EPA for its comments.
EPA believes that South Dakota should review the four-factor analysis regarding the SNCR infeasibility for peat lanes and suns. The information provided is incorrect, and South Dakota has since been provided with accurate information regarding the subject.
For discussion purposes, DANR re-ran peat lanes cost analysis by using EPA preferred inputs and by eliminating the cost for the last kiln dust sales. The dollar per ton cost would decrease from $34,860 per ton to approximately $11,400 per ton for kiln number one, and from $58,830 per ton to $17,400 per ton for kiln number two. Even with these revisions, DANR would still consider the SNCR not cost-effective and would not require PD and Sons to install the control system at this time.
EPA would like South Dakota to specify which NEI year was used and how in the four-factor analysis for PD and Sons. If emissions data prior to 2017 NEI was used, EPA requests that the state analyze and present updated 2017 emissions information.
DANR understands that emissions information from 2014 to 2017 do not change significantly. Only minor changes to emissions can be expected during this time period.
EPA requests that for each selected source, the state consider whether a source can achieve a lower emission rate using its existing control measures. EPA also recommends the state consider equipment upgrades or more efficient use of existing measures being a reasonable way to reduce emissions.
DANR acknowledges that such additional control suggestions may reduce emissions, but DANR does not believe further analysis on the topic is necessary at this time.
EPA believes that SNCR should be acceptable to implement at GCC Dakota due to numerous individual reasons. These reasons include that the state is currently complying with all particulate matter and NAAQS. The fact that the state has previously asserted that exceedances of PM10 in Rapid City were due to uncontrollable natural events, and that the state must comply with both the CAA and the RHR.
DANR does not agree with EPA's conclusion. DANR has followed all requirements of the Clean Air Act and Regional ACE Rule and has made reasonable interpretations.
EPA recommends that South Dakota, EPA recommends South Dakota complete a four-factor analysis providing reason as to why Big Stone Power Plant should be excluded from consideration of additional emission control measures instead of automatically excluding them from this implementation period.
DANR did not automatically disregard Big Stone Power Plants. South Dakota did not include Big Stone Power Plants for a four-factor analysis because it was not screened in during the source selection step using established and even more stringent thresholds.
EPA believes that if no additional or new measures are required to make reasonable progress for a particular source, the state should determine whether the source's existing measures are required to make reasonable progress. If this is the case, South Dakota will need to adopt emissions limits based on those existing controls.
South Dakota did consider existing control measures and reasonable progress determination.
EPA recommends that in the draft SIP document, existing emission limits are identified and the state explains where the limits are located, for example, in the SIP or in the state permit, etc.
The facilities are permitted and these permits identify the emission limits that are required to be met.
EPA would like more clarification on the dry sorbent injection used for kiln number 6 at GCC Dakota. EPA would like to know if it is used for continuous reduction of SO2 or in order to meet an emission limit on a short-term basis.
It was used to meet the federal max standard for HCL if they ever have a spike. It was not put there to meet the SO2 requirements.
EPA would like further information on the initial basis to implement control technologies on kiln number 6 at GCC Dakota and the reasoning behind the decision to remove the requirement at a later date.
The reasoning behind the decision to remove this requirement is that the SCR system was originally required at GCC Dakota. The requirement was removed because they didn't need it to make sure they were meeting the emission limits that was established under that system.
EPA recommends that South Dakota focus the analysis of source on direct energy consumption rather than indirect energy inputs. EPA would also like to point out that just because a control measure would create liquid and solid waste that would need to be disposed of does not mean that it is not necessary to make reasonable progress, especially if it has been implemented at other facilities. EPA would like the state to provide more information on how ammonia slip would negatively impact the state if they are to use it as a reason to not implement control measures at a site. In rare instances, new controls or increasing the efficiency of existing control measures might result in adverse energy or non-air quality environmental impacts. If this is the case, such impacts should generally be addressed in the context of a four-factor analysis rather than be used as a reason to not analyze increased efficiency of the measure in the first instance.
South Dakota considered the environmental impacts factor to the extent it deems reasonable. Ammonia slip would potentially negatively affect PM10 values in the Rapid City area.
EPA states that Peking and Sons four-factor analysis indicates potential lime kiln dust product sales loss of greater than $1.1 million to greater than $1.4 million for kilns 1 and 2 from ammonia impacts to lime dust quality, and that no justification has been provided for their sales loss figures.
This is a similar response to comments number 8. It's, for discussion purposes, DANR reran PGE's cost analysis by using EPA preferred inputs and by eliminating the cost for the lost kiln dust sales. The dollar per ton cost would decrease from roughly $34,000 per ton to approximately $11,000 per ton for kiln number 1, and from $58,000 per ton to $17,000 per ton for kiln number 2. Even with these revisions, DANR would still consider the SNCR not cost-effective and would not require Peatley and Sons to install the control system at this time.
EPA indicates that continuous progress over planning periods may be necessary to meet the intent of Congress in Section 169A of the Clean Air Act, and that EPA has concerns with states that choose to forego any additional cost-effective controls during the second implementation period because the sources are insignificant contributors to visibility impairment. Instead, South Dakota should consider a source's visibility impact relative to its own total contribution to impairment, not other states.
South Dakota agrees that continuous progress over planning periods may be necessary to meet the intent of Congress, but it is not possible to know definitively until more approved data comes in. South Dakota disagrees that insignificant sources of visibility impairment need to be controlled during the second implementation period, especially if those controls amount to a fraction of a percent of visibility impairment change at any classified area.
Final comment. EPA encourages South Dakota to consider environmental justice impacts inside and outside the state, and to describe any outreach to environmental justice communities or opportunities provided or plans to provide for communities to give feedback on its proposed strategy.
EANR does not agree that South Dakota needs to consider environmental justice impacts, as the topic is not mentioned in the regional ACE rule. However, we did public notice our information twice in 11 daily newspapers, and therefore the general public was informed. We also put information up on our website since September of last year.
Are you saying that's the end of all the comments?
So you say that this bill run from the EPA came in right at the end?
This last portion was 4:30 yesterday. And this year.
So somebody had to do some work to.
Yes, they did.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I am a little concerned that the first round they had no interest, I guess, in the first round of to come in, and then this last minute type deal is, I guess, a little bit disturbing to me, being on my side, is because what lit the fire? Oh, bad word. Does anybody have any idea? I mean,
I actually have maybe an answer for you. I spoke with a representative from EPA yesterday in response to their late submittal of comments. I actually spoke with them for a good hour, and one of the topics brought up was the fact that there were many comments that came in at the last minute, and I was curious if this was something that was unique to our state, or if it was something that was more applicable to all of the states in the West, at least. And the representative told me that it was not at all unique to our states. It was just something that EPA decided to do with all of the states, more or less. There were quite a few comments given to every state, and just because we had quite a few and at the last minute, it's, in my interpretation of what he told me, it's not that significant.
It happened in 2011, too, when it went to Custer. We were reviewing comments on the way down to the state because they came in, 5 o'clock, 9:04.
Mr. Chair. So, in reviewing this letter, there's not a date on it, but this is a letter that y'all received within the last 24 hours?
That is correct. They submitted it originally through our web portal system, the public notice web page. So they submitted it through that system, and we received it yesterday around 4:30.
Okay, but the letter itself indicates that they completed an initial review of the SIP some time ago, and they made recommendations. You analyzed and assessed those recommendations, and based on those recommendations, you did make changes to the proposed SIP. Is that correct?
So, the National Park Service did some new comments during the original 60-day comment period, which those guys went through. This was basically just a follow-up letter. And as far as the changes go, I'm not 100% certain. Anthony might know what the changes were.
because they indicated in there, so they had the opportunity to review previous, and they say, we appreciate the revisions made in the proposed SIP to address some of the EPA's prior comments. And so then those changes were made, they reviewed that, and that review is what generated this letter.
To help with that one, and it's again, EPA submitted informal comments. They did not submit it during the comment periods we established. They submitted it in between for whatever reason. And some of those comments that I'm recalling, and I'll have to end the like, for example, we identified Otter Tail, Big Stone, North Wheat. Basically, the facility, we identified it three or four different ways. They asked us to clean that up, which we did. We cleaned that aspect up. They had questions on, we talked about why the reasons we were discounting the control system. Well, we identified we did a four-factor. We rewrote that four-factor analysis to say, we're saying it's not costly. Here's the four factors. This is each one. We identified each one to clean those up. We did that in between these formal comment periods with the comments that we see.
Okay. So, I mean, the staff took those informal comments to heart and addressed those the best they could in the proposed SIP that we're being presented today.
We considered it where we thought they were appropriate. We obviously still disagree on what's cost effective.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Eventually, you know, the state will approve this board and pass it on to back to EPA.
If the board approves it at this portion, then we will prepare the package to submit to EPA for approval. And EPA will have to go through the process to see if they approve it or disapprove it. Obviously,
so
they disapprove.
Eventually, they'll put a rubber stamp on. After we get through all the comments and addressing the comments and so forth and so on.
Or they'll reject it and change it.
Where's the end?
It's going to basically, will they approve it or disapprove it? If they approve it, they'll go through a public noticing, they approve the system, they'll put it in the Federal Register, they'll take comments from the public again to see if they should approve it. If they decide to disapprove it, then we have to make a determination how we want to go forward.
Okay.
Type thing. Basically, I can't, because we didn't have to do it, but I will identify in the first round other states, EPA disapproved theirs and they had to go to court and they're still not resolved with the first set of rounds in some states. It's still going through that process because they can't agree what's cost effective or what should be installed.
Any further comments or questions from board members?
There's a little date in there. Is that the one you're done with the signature? There's a real small date in there, 420.
Okay. Greenfield will make a motion to approve of the SIP as presented to the board to be submitted to the EPA.
Motion by Greenfield. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by England. Further comments from the board? Hearing none. I think we'll do this one as a roll call vote because of everything involved with it.
Okay. England?
Aye.
Carpin?
Aye.
Morris?
Aye.
Greenfield?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Sheets? Blumhardt?
Aye. Motion is approved.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Nice job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we take a 5-minute stretch break?
Yeah, we can. We'll take a short break and then we'll handle the mining issues. And so.
You know, I probably.
All right, I guess we might as well get going again. Consent calendar. We might as well do the consent calendar first. There you are. All right. Anything on here we need to worry about? Anybody, any board members got any questions on any of this? What did we change? What is this page here that we just took?
Morris moves to approve as presented consent calendar, April 21, 2022.
Second.
Okay. Further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And my understanding is, Mr. Burt, we get to visit with you today. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, update on post-closure financial assurance for LAC Minerals USA LLC large-scale mine permit 445.
Just to start out with, I wanted to point out the spreadsheet that was provided to the board originally with the board packet.
Yeah.
That was an incorrect value for the lack bond. The one that was supplied originally was, it said $21,789,741. The correct number is $20,340,567. I believe an updated page was provided for the meeting.
What's the correct number?
It was laying on your
phone. Yeah, it's this one here, Bob.
It's the 29.
You think the correct number.
Okay.
Yeah. It's on page 2 of this, too, of our slides.
Thank you.
Reclaimed acres and 73.33 unreclaimed acres used for water management and treatment were placed under the post-closure plan. And that post-closure bond is recalculated during the five-year review. And that's a requirement under the post-closure plan and post-closure condition. Currently, we're requesting approval of an update to LAC Mineral post-closure financial assurance. The post-closure period under bond reduced is currently being reduced to 94 years, and it ends in 2115. And that's giving credit for the past 6 years of it being a post-closure. So 2021, year one. That post-closure financial insurance covers the water treatment, water monitoring, and maintenance of the post-closure areas. The current financial insurance, as I mentioned, is $20,340,567. The updated amount is $30,838,220. So the additional financial insurance that would be added update is $10,497,652. The reasons for this increase include inflation, standard inflation of labor, heavy equipment costs and seed costs, water treatment, water sample analysis, and estimated site closure costs for year 94. It also includes some new costs associated with pipeline and power line removal. Increased support staff and sales tax, and it also includes a new five-year site closure monitoring and fence removal. So for 5 years after the end of post-closure, this additional activity would happen in year 105. This is a map of LAC Minerals, our 2021 post-closure bond map. What this accounts for, the red hatched areas are areas that are reclaimed and have been paved in the post-closure. The purple areas are areas that are still covered under the reclamation bond. And then also the areas outlined in yellow and orange, which are unreclaimed and topsoil stockpiles. Areas currently covered under the reclamation bond, that reclamation bond is $61,000 at the moment. So we base our post-closure financial assurance on several assumptions. We evaluate perpetual water treatment calculations throughout the post-closure period. And we develop those based on what other states and other federal agencies are doing. We also do a present worth analysis of the annual costs and adjust those analyses for inflation. We then do a sum of those present words to calculate the post-closure bond. During this, I suppose this isn't an assumption, but we used for the actual water treatment costs and maintenance costs, we actually, Black Minerals was able to provide us with their costs for the past 5 years, from 2016 to 2020, and that's what those costs are actually currently based on in this analysis. So these are the annual operation and maintenance costs. We calculated the weed control, fence repair, erosion control, vehicle fuel and maintenance, and pond liner repair and maintenance based off of values provided to us by LAC based on what they have done over the past 5 years. So those are based off of actual costs. The road maintenance cost we have assessed is for the use of the site caretaker to use a grader at the site as necessary, and then also an ATV cost to access areas around the site from a vendor. And then also pond liner replacement is currently assessed for an assumption of 815,000 square feet of liner in the storage, feed, and spruce gulch ponds, and that is assessed at $2 per square foot for replacement. We also have indirect costs associated with this, including the mobilization, contractor overhead, contractor profits, state excise tax, the contingencies, administration, engineering, consulting, and scope and bid. Mobilization, scope and bid, those are calculated. They're only applied every 10 years, beginning in year 7. So this would be 2021, adjusted year 1, so that's 2021. These are the annual water treatment costs, and these are based the plant reagents, the propane, electricity, diesel, rental, and equipment replacement costs. Those are based off of LAC's average cost for the past 5 years, from 2016 to 2020. And then we also assumed a value of $300,000 for the RL unit replacement and for plant overhaul cost of $200,000. And those happen, those last two only happen once every 25 years. The plant manager and operator costs for the water treatment plant are currently not addressed in the LAC post-closure bond because those are actually handled through Homestake. The Blacktail Water Treatment at Homestake currently handles this remotely, so it's handled under the Homestake bond instead of the LAC bond. This is the flow chart for the water treatment plant at Richmond Hill. So the water treatment process currently consists of reverse osmosis and biological treatment. Effluent from cap leach pads is collected in the feed pond, it's filtered, and then treated in the reverse osmosis unit to remove selenium. Concentrate from the RO unit is then run through the biological treatment circuit, and then permeate from the reverse osmosis unit is then blended with treated water from the biologic circuit and then discharged at compliance point 004 and down Rubicon Gulch to the north of it. You'll see this slide a lot. Indirect treatment, indirect costs through all this. Again, mobilization, contractor, overhead, profit, tax, contingency administration, the engineering and consultants go in bid. The asterisks beside mobilization, engineering, consulting, scope, and bid is applied every 10 years, with year 1 being 2021. So the water sample analysis costs, these are the annual monitoring costs associated with the mine for water sampling. We have these analyses are based off of the required parameters currently in their water sampling list for the site. and we evaluate that with the lab cost with a 15% discount from the lab. And then we also have an additional post-closure year 7/12 and 17 of $40,000. That is based on additional parameters that are required as part of the aquatic and biological monitoring that happens in those years. So just as year 1, 6, and 11, that would be 2021, 2027, and so on. Currently, we have, it ends at year 17. That aquatic biological monitoring ends in post-closure year 17 or just a year 11. Based on current surface water discharge requirements, so I'd say that might actually continue. It depends upon what happens with surface water discharge at that time, if it's still in the requirements of that, and it might have to be extended. But at this time, it is scheduled to end in year 17. Pit impoundment monitoring, these are annual costs based off of what LAC has done from 2016 to 2020. These are the annual indirect costs associated with the monitoring requirements. In year 94, we have the final closure costs. So this is the final reclamation that has to happen at the site based on the closure of the water treatment facilities and final reclamation of some of the roads. So these are costs we assume to happen. We have to have a surveyor at the site plugs monitoring wells, any remaining monitoring wells. The Spruce Gulch facilities and ponds, and the South Gulch water treatment facilities and ponds, those both have to be removed. Process area water treatment facility will be removed. Maintenance and any remaining maintenance in new buildings. Removal of the haul road and providing a newer, smaller access road. Any building and other demolition costs that might be assessed during this time, and also pipeline and power line removal and the labor for a total of $2,413,000. We have those same indirect costs associated with these, with that number, and we applied those, and the total cost after applying the indirect cost came to $3,595,695. This here is for the inspection and monitoring that would happen 5 years after the removal of all these facilities in year 94, so this would be year 99, and then final fence removal at the site. We assessed that cost to be $51,497. And that is based off of an estimated 11,420 feet of fence at that time. So that's what that fence removal is evaluated at. And these are the indirect costs associated with that last inspection. We have additional contingencies for potential for cap failure contingency of $200,000 and mitigation of $100,000 to fix any of the problems. In development of post-closure financial assurance, we do a present work analysis. We base that analysis on with discussions we have with the State Investment Council on what should be used for proper inflation and discount rates. Historically, it's always been a 2% difference between the two rates, with the inflation rate usually being around 3% and the discount rate being at 5%. And currently, those two numbers are applied to all of the large-scale coal mine post-closure bonds. So what we first do is we calculate, we do the inflation adjustment on this. So each annual cost, we have the direct and indirect, and then first we do the inflation. So we take the annual cost, we assess that for 3% inflation factor, and we calculate what the future value would be over that 100-year period. And then we bring it back for a present worth analysis, and we use that. We calculate that with a discount rate. So we take the present value is the discount rate over the 100 years, and then multiply that by the inflated value. As mentioned earlier, for the present worth analysis, we adjusted the post-closure period so that year one is actually year 7 post-closure period. So we give them credit for that initial 6 years. This is year 20. So the escalation of personal worth factors beginning year 7 and adjusted first year post-closure for year 11. So the annual cost, for an example that is provided here, for year 4, we assume the annual cost estimated for activities beginning year 4 is $501,000. We use the escalation factor and calculate a 3% inflation rate of 1.1255, and that comes out $564,095. Once you put in the present worth factor and count the discount rate, it brings that back down and multiply that in. That brings it back down to $464,082, and that would be the value assessed. So the present value from year 1 to year 99 is $29,369,733. If we take that present value and include the discount rate, that actually raised a little bit, to $30,838,220. So in 2022, this value is $30,838,220. And this slide shows what that value would be over the next 5 years until we do the 5-year reunion. So you can see it goes up each year, ending in 2026 at $34,761,000. So what we're doing here today, the board, we're looking for the board to approve the amount of the updated financial assurance. And then LAC will have to supply a surety bond writer for the new amount. And once that's done, we'll come back next month and present that at the May hearing so that you can approve the writer. Currently, our recommendation is to approve the increase in economic exposure and financial terms from $20,740,067 to
$30,838,000. Greg has a question.
I have two questions. That's a pretty big jump. What would you say the reasons for the jump are? I mean, going from 20 to 30 is a pretty good hop, skip, and a jump. That's question number one. And question number two, I've been thinking about this. When you reduce it on a discount to present value, that assumes that we get all of the surety bond proceeds at once. Is that the way that it would actually work, or would we get the surety proceeds payable over time as it's spent, so we shouldn't be doing such a big reduction in the discount rate?
Right, so have to bear with me here.
Yep.
Not the normal bond person,
right.
I'm sure you guys all know this. So your first question is, why are the costs so jumping up $10 million? I believe right now that primary thing is because we have added new costs to this, being the pipeline removal and power line removal, and then also the necessity for increased staff. You have to remember this analysis, and this might partially answer your second question, this analysis is done over 100 years. That present worth analysis going into the future 100 years, it does something. So we bring that back. But the thing we're looking at here is that this assesses all of the activities that are planned to be done currently over that 100 years.
And that's what I'm worried about, because when you're reducing it to the discount value, the difference between the all of them, you're assuming that the bond company gives us all of that money at once, and we get to invest it, and we get to make that money during that time frame. But I'm not sure that's the way that it works. I think they hand out the money on the surety bond over time. So I actually think that if you do it the way that I'm thinking we should do it, the amount would be more, because I think Eric is assuming we get all of that money to put in a big pile for ourselves. I don't think we do. I think that we get that paid over time. So I think it's being discounted too much to value.
Yeah, right now, I think if we were to claim it, we would claim the entire $30 million.
Okay, and if we can, that's good, because then all of these assumptions are
it's
right.
Based on us being able to get that $30 million, if LAC walks away,
right.
It's based on us getting that $30 million and being able to use it as we need to for the next 100.
Right, but we get it.
Yeah.
We get it in our pot.
Yes. That's what our analysis is based on, is us getting that money.
I'm just hoping that's what the bond says.
Did anyone else have any other questions?
A very elementary question. Excuse me for my ignorance, but the discount rate, what's a quick definition of the discount rate?
Okay, how come you guys wouldn't ask me that?
We got an economist up here. We got some attorneys here. Maybe they can.
What they're saying is that if you took a pot of money and you invested that money, you would make a certain amount of return minus different things. And so instead of getting the pot of money, because you're able to invest it and get a certain percentage rate of return, we're going to discount the amount of the cost by the amount of that return. And so you discount to present value from future value, because they're saying you get the money and you get to use it, and that's part of your return. So you should be including that. And if you're going to do that, then we reduce it, discount it to present value, okay? Because we get the money and we get to invest it. And that's what my question was. I'm fine with doing discount value calculations, but is the assumption that if they default, we get all of the bond money at once? Or does the bonding company say, well, you go start doing things and we'll pay you out over time? If we get it all at once, all of this is right. If the bond is, well, you go spend it and we'll we'll give it to you, then the discount rate.
If, Mr. Chairman, I think we'd have to receive the bond all at once, because after something, a payout such as this, there won't be a bonding company then. And also, question, slide 19, I mean, that 105 years, that's after post-closure? That's optimism, isn't it? You looked around this room?
Yeah,
I mean, we got one board member might
have
a chance.
We don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I know I'm out.
I'm good for the five.
Yeah. Well, I'm betting on tomorrow. So.
Any other questions?
So, we need a motion then?
Yeah, let's handle this separately. Do you want You want to do a motion, Doyle, to raise the...
Yes, I guess take the recommendation of the department to increase it to $39,838,220.
Okay. Is there a second to that motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Morris. Further discussion from the board? Hearing none. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. All right. You also win the transfer of small scale mine 479 from Timothy R. Horn to Robert W. Pace. Okay.
Okay. So Robert Pace has requested transfer of small scale mine permit 479 from Timmy Horn. The general location of the permitted operation is approximately 3 miles east of Rochford, South Dakota, under SDCL 456B47. Any mine permit can be transferred from one operator to another with the successor operator assuming all reclamation liability. For this application, we received the completed transfer application on March 28th, 2022. Their fee was submitted on February 28th of 2022. We received the replacement surety, the $2,500 replacement surety, on March 23rd of 2022. And we determined the application was complete on March 28th of 2022. We prepared our recommendation on March 28th of 2022 and had that published in the Rapid City Journal on April 7th and April 14th of 2022 and we received those affidavits of publication on April 19th. Under SDCL 456B47, the board cannot deny a mine permit transfer unless the operation is not or cannot be brought into compliance with all applicable federal, state, or local laws, or the successor operator is in violation of state mining laws or mine permit conditions for any mining operation in the state. The current mine permit and Mr. Pace are in compliance with all federal, state, and local laws and regulations. Mr. Pace also submitted a certification of active form and disclosed no violations. Our recommendation is to transfer small-scale mine permit 479 to Mr. Pace, and release CD number 2201-46644, First Interstate Bank, Gillette, Wyoming, in the amount of $2,500, and accept CD number 6701-000601, First Interstate Bank, New Underwood, South Dakota, in the amount of $2,500.
Any questions from the board?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Second. Any further comments by board members?
I just have one question, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Reverting to $2,500, is this where we have a statute that gives that says $20,000 for all permits or $500 an acre, depending on which the operator wants to post?
So under 456B, a small-scale mine permit is capped at $2,500.
Okay.
So it
can't go higher.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? There's a First Interstate Bank in New Underwood and in...
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
Yes, there is.
Okay. Old spell checker here.
So, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Roberta. We are now to the point in the meeting where we have public comment period according to South Dakota Codified Law 125.1. Is there anyone on the phone that has any comments?
Or Mike?
Yeah, Mike's the only one here, and I don't think Mike has any, so... Hearing none and seeing none, we will then close the public comment period for the Board of Minerals Environment for its April 21st meeting. Brenda, next meeting?
May 19th. And that is when we do the annual oral mining reports.
Yep.
And we have just a couple other small things on the agenda. And then today,
the post-closure.
Yeah. So is that one going to be here?
Excuse
is
me?
That going to be here?
I don't know yet. I usually leave that up to us.
Okay. All right.
And then I also have an agenda started for June. And I already checked that this year the bar convention is the week after our board meeting, so there's no conflict.
Oh, really?
We possibly may have a contested case enforcement hearing next in June, possibly.
Definitely. He gave us his letter requesting the hearing. So
okay, so that will be an in-person meeting in June.
Okay, and that's June what?
That is June 16th.
June 16th. Okay.
Yeah.
For what kind of permit or license?
It's Bobby's deal.
Stay ambiguous at the moment.
It's top secret.
He has a license, but he isn't. We issued an NOV on this, and he's contesting that NOV.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.